This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. There are a few things that can completely change the trajectories of our lives. Becoming a parent for the first time is one, and caring for our parents can be another. And so it has been for Debbie Rhodes. As she sits in our studio before our interview, she's looking at her phone to check on her mother, who has advanced stage Alzheimer's.
She's at home on 5 cameras that I have on her in every room. And I have a door alarm, so if she tries to go outside, it goes off.
Can you show me?
As we wait for her phone to pull up the cameras, Rhodes tells me she's been her parents' caregiver for 7 years. Her father passed 3 years ago, and now it's just her mother, and she's a handful.
It was a lot easier when Dad was around. He could help somewhat. So he was sharp as a pin till he died, but Mom's with her dementia or Alzheimer's, it's getting really hard. Here, I can show you the camera. I had it installed 5 years ago.
And has it helped?
It has helped a lot. She's not on that camera. Let me find her in a different one. It would really help when I was at work.
So Mom is sitting in a chair in what, the living room there?
She's in the living room. Mm-hmm. And she's holding her baby doll that I bought her for company.
So she has a caregiver at home too?
Well, she lives on my same property, so I'm her caretaker via the cameras when I'm not there or via Home Instead.
Home Instead is the Home Instead Senior Care Network, an agency that provides a variety of caregiving services.
My role over the last 10 years has changed. I went from full-time working, full-time business, empty nester for a few months there, and then Dad and Mom got sick. So Dad had to have diabetic shots twice a day, couldn't do much of anything else, but he was still sharp as a pin, and Mom's Alzheimer's had kicked in. And it evolved that with her Alzheimer's, she just kind of got wild. She jumped on the hood of my car. She held me at gunpoint with a .357 Magnum. I had to call work and say, I'm going to be late for my break. I have to wait for the police to come. Because you can't force somebody to go to the doctors. We kept saying something's wrong. My dad kept saying something's wrong. But you can't force them. So one night, my dad called the police and said that Mom punched him. She said he punched her, and they both went to jail. So Mom finally got help.
She got her parents out of jail. Doctors put her mother on medication, and Rhodes' burdens increased.
I was trying to do caretakers while I was working, and my dad would fire them. And it was so stressful. They gave me a TIA and an aneurysm over that time period before I hired Home Instead.
TIA?
Yeah, a mini stroke.
Oh, my.
So I told them both they were going to kill me before they ever died.
So did you not have anybody other than you, no spouse, no siblings to help?
No, my brother lives in California. My mom kept stripping naked, so my husband couldn't help either.
I see.
Yeah, and my sons, they were kind of out of the picture to help, and my daughter doesn't live in Washington State. So it was me, and that's when I put all the cameras in so I could see her while I was at work. And I could see the caretakers, too, when I wasn't there, and could help them out when I'd see Mom get combative.
Debbie Rhodes had a conundrum with which many adult children can empathize. She had a mother whose mind was going but whose body was fine. She had a father whose failing health meant his ability to help was limited. The stress was making her sick, and the clock was ticking on the resources she had available to hire independent caregivers.
She had a long-term care policy that only lasted 2 years. And so I was waiting until the point that I just couldn't manage anymore by myself with part-time help. But my dad kept firing him. They'd call me at work and say, I just got fired. And that's the day I had my TIA because I got so mad at my dad.
Oh, my gosh.
So I don't remember leaving work. I went home, and my dad said I was really mad at him, madder than he's ever seen. And then I just kind of screamed and grabbed my head and was gone.
Eventually, Rhodes hit her breaking point. Her father died, but she couldn't care for her mother alone. So she called the Home Instead Agency and Christy Amons.
We have an emergency-driven business. We get a frantic phone call from a daughter or a son. They're just fed up. they're being pulled so many different directions that they cannot cope. So we step in, usually in an emergency, quickly, like we did with Debbie, and provide not just care for the parent, but it allows the daughter to be a daughter when we're there. Debbie was at work for a lot of the time until just recently. She was able to go to work knowing somebody would be there with her mother.
Rhodes' long-term care policy has paid for about 2 years' worth of care, and she says that has helped immensely, allowing the caregiver to do the day-to-day chores and Rhodes to be a daughter while the help is there. But she's about at the end of that. From now on, she'll have to pay out of pocket for outside care, so there's financial stress and there's the mental and emotional toll.
You get to the point where you feel so guilty that you're mad at her, that you get mad at her for the way she's changed your life or the fact that she right-hooked you in the jaw because you let the caretaker back in the house that she locked out. And then you have to remember she can't help it. And I like her best when she's sleeping now. Well, I can watch her and she's sleeping nicely.
Last December, because of her mother's situation, Rhodes left her job with the Spokane County Library District. She said she's reviving a home-based business she operated several years ago while she manages her mother's care. Meanwhile, Mom continues to go through her combative phases.
Sometimes it feels like your mother's died. And then other times you see little glimpses. And yesterday it was horrifying because she looked at me and she goes, I can't do this anymore. She had a moment of clarity. She goes, I never wanted this for my life and I can't do this anymore. What are we going to do? And I said, Mom, we're doing the best we can.
It should be noted that Debbie Rhodes also has a husband at home and a son and two small grandchildren and two dogs. Together they manage to keep the household going while Debbie oversees her mother's care. Rhodes says she's sharing her story because she hopes others who have their own situations will learn from her experiences. Christy Amons from Home Instead says stories like this are becoming more common, and more services are becoming available, too, for families. Some are private pay, some offered by governments. To find out more about them, one good source is the agency known as Aging and Long-Term Care of Eastern Washington. She says some companies also have employee assistance programs for people who are caring for parents. And Home Instead has a new program that provides support for adult children. It's called Daughters in the Workplace because daughters are more likely to take responsibility for the care of their parents. You can find more information at daughtersintheworkplace.com. Washington's mental health system is having its difficulties. Western State Hospital has lost its federal funding because it's not viewed as a safe place for patients. Governor Jay Inslee says the system needs to move from an institution-based system to one that helps more people at community-based facilities. A Vancouver, Washington mom is leading a new effort to improve that system. Jerry Clark created the group Mothers of the Mentally Ill after she says her college-age son was booked into jail and attempted suicide by jumping off a bridge. And now Clark and her fellow moms are sharing their stories and putting pressure on the governor and state lawmakers to improve the system. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has more.
On a recent Wednesday night, the Vancouver, Washington affiliate of the National Alliance on Mental Illness was bustling.
At some point, we're literally going to have to put people on hold. Yeah.
It was standing room only for a forum sponsored by the group Mothers of the Mentally Ill.
Hi. Welcome.
Founder Jerry Clark greeted the audience of about 80 people, many of them families with adult children with severe mental illness.
I believe that the size of this evening's audience is an indication that mental health care reform is an idea whose time has come.
Clark describes Washington's mental health system as a miserable underworld that forces people with serious mental illness to become criminals before they get the help they need. During the forum, she asked for a show of hands as she ran through a list of what families are often told when trying to access help for their loved ones, including this line.
I probably shouldn't say this, but some parents let their children hurt them so they can meet criteria for services.
Clark's story begins in February 2015. That's when her son Calvin, a college freshman and debate champion, was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Calvin had to leave school, and over the next 3 years, he cycled in and out of mental hospitals, attempted suicide, and even landed in jail.
My son is not a criminal, but I watched the system systematically criminalize his illness.
Clark says Calvin would stop taking his medications and then spiral through episodes of mania. But until he posed a threat to himself or others or committed a crime, she says there was little to no help available. A breaking point came the day Calvin jumped off the I-5 bridge over the Columbia River in a suicide attempt.
I just vaulted over the railing.
Calvin says as soon as he hit the water, he knew he wanted to live. He was able to swim to shore where rescuers were waiting. After that, he went into a residential treatment facility. Looking back now, Calvin sees irony.
I mean, what? Like, I had to actually attempt to take my own life to even start to get the help that I needed.
Earlier this year, Calvin had another mental health crisis and was jailed in King County. He's doing better now, but that's when his mom started Mothers of the Mentally Ill. In June, a group of 17 families met briefly with Governor Jay Inslee. They also spent several hours with his policy advisor on mental health.
There were a lot of tears and emotion in the room.
Rashi Gupta says the willingness of so many families to share their stories represents a shift.
In the past, there's been a lot of stigma around people speaking up, and I think that it is one of the most important things that can happen in this process.
These families aren't just telling their stories. They've come up with specific proposals to improve Washington's mental health system. The list includes reforms to the state's Involuntary Treatment Act, more hospital beds for the severely mentally ill, and more services before a patient ends up jailed or hospitalized under court order. At the recent gathering in Vancouver, Jerry Clark had a message for the state lawmakers in the room.
We are not going to wait and wait and wait and watch our children die and suffer and struggle because the state can't figure this out.
Clark plans to bring that message to the state capitol in January when the legislature convenes. She says Governor Inslee has pledged that mental health will be a top priority. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Many tenants in Spokane feel powerless to speak up against their landlords, especially if they live in substandard housing. On Wednesday, Spokane City Councilwoman Kate Burke gave them a forum to speak out. At the Northeast Community Center, she gathered representatives from social service and legal agencies to answer questions from tenants. On two pillars in a downstairs room, she posted items that tenants sometimes complain about and asked them to rate the problems that are most acute in their lives. Rent increases was the number one complaint. A speaker named Jeremy, who said he moved from Seattle 5 years ago because he couldn't afford to live there anymore, moved to Westview Manor on the South Hill, where a new owner recently took possession of the building.
The first day of the new ownership, we got a rent increase of $475 a month. We had 30 days to come up with the new rent or move.
Jeremy went to a local TV station, which did a story, and that led to tenants getting an extra month to adjust to the increase or to get some financial help to move to another place.
Since I've been in Spokane, which is a little over 5 years, rent has almost doubled.
Other tenants talked about the number two complaint, non-responsive landlords. Monica Tittle shared a story about being homeless until she found a room at a downtown apartment building, not knowing it was a place where released sex offenders live.
I was in a very low, beyond low standard apartment that had no way of closing my door. I had no electricity half the time on our floor, no running water. We had no heat, no air. And I was also, due to the fact that it was supposed to be a secure building and it was not, my ex was able to get in and raped and beat me for 2 days.
Tittle said she went to a city council meeting to share her story and found herself being evicted later. Kate Burke told the crowd that the city has moved slowly to help tenants, much slower than she'd like. It's been a heavy lift, she says.
So as you heard from the story from Monica about the Washington apartments, we can't shut them down. We can't do anything about the lack of heat. We can't do anything about the lack of electricity because we don't have quality standards for housing in our great city.
She says the city is developing minimum quality standards for housing. Terry Anderson from the Tenants Union of Washington State says half of Spokane's people rent. Two-thirds of whites own their own homes. Two-thirds of people of color rent. She urges people to take charge of their situations.
You can't always find a lawyer. You might not always be able to pay for a lawyer. And we do have some nonprofit legal offices here, but they have capacity. And so they can only take so many cases, and they have to prioritize and limit what they take. So oftentimes it's up to you as tenants to take action yourself in order to get things done.
Anderson says her organization would like to see the city of Spokane adopt a law that requires landlords to cite justifiable reasons before evicting tenants.
Because as the law currently stands, a tenant just gets a 20-day notice for no reason and they have to move.
Kate Burke says last year she was required to move when her landlord told her that he was going to sell her house. She said because of her status and her ability to pay a bit more, she was able to quickly find a better house for her. She later found out the home in which she originally lived was never sold. For that reason and others, she said, she's become especially sensitive to tenants' issues. This is Inland Journal. The co-owner of Spokane's Winescape Winery has grapes on his mind. In a few weeks, Phil Butterfield will load several half-ton stainless steel bins onto a trailer and haul them down to a vineyard in the Tri-Cities.
We have everything picked by hand. I load those onto my trailer in the morning, bring them up here.
He delivers them to a room whose main feature is a big conveyor belt where the grapes get their initial attention.
We're able to dump those bins. I have a forklift and it has a rotator. Rotate the bin, dump them in there. It elevates them up into the this unit up here, which is our destemmer.
The machine removes the stems and the grapes are dropped into bins where they start the fermentation process. Eventually, the wine is pumped into oak casks that are stacked in the next room, which is kept at a chilly 55 degrees. Winescape is one of the newest of Spokane's 20 or so wineries, and its proprietors are new to the business. Phil and Pat Butterfield have had long careers as health researchers. Pat once served as dean of WSU's College of Nursing in Spokane. And now Phil has retired from WSU, completing a transition to full-time entrepreneur.
As you know, you've often heard about farmers and ranchers, and I think wineries are the same thing. They're successful because somebody in the family is still working. I think that's Pat, mostly.
Phil is the craftsman, the man who turns the grapes into vintages that people want to drink. And Pat, who has directed research projects in her professional life, plays a supporting role here.
I do a lot of the grunt work, and then I do some things to let people know who we are and what our story is.
That story started on Spokane's South Hill 8 or 10 years ago when the Butterfields began getting interested in wine. Phil made wine in his garage, and when they began making plans for the winery, they decided they'd need a place that had more space. So they bought property on the Glen Rose Prairie.
We didn't have a vineyard, and that's fine because we knew how to source great grapes. But what we wanted to do was not get somebody else's warehouse. We wanted to do our own production facility. So we had to learn how to design it. We worked with Tom Kundig, a fabulous Seattle-based architect, to create a space that is very, very simple and makes great wine.
Phil Butterfield is an environmental engineer. He knows his way around a laboratory, and that helps when it comes to planning and making wine.
I know chemistry well, so any of the chemistry things that go on in winemaking, I tend to understand and feel very comfortable with. I think it's always those artistic parts of winemaking that are the hardest to learn, and that's what I'm working on now, is trying to get the other side of the brain to function better.
For me, I think a lot of it is just in creating experiences for people. And I feel I'm a public health scientist, and so I'm interested in how people move collectively to kind of empower their own health. And I never would have thought this 10 years ago, but wine and experience and having things where people have a nature of connection through food or drink is a powerful part of that. And I've enjoyed, you know, watching Phil in terms of the analytic part and then helping support that.
One of Phil Butterfield's early winemaking partners was Michael Ebinger, director of WSU's Center for Innovation. He offered some early help as the team began developing Winescape.
They now have this destination where people can actually come. And if you go out on a really nice day, there are people inside, there are people outside, and the whole place is a buzz. It's great. You can't do that in town. You don't have parking. You don't have the attractive location, et cetera. That's really difficult. Phil's also enabled himself to have quite a capacity for winemaking.
So there's room for growth in terms of building an inventory of wine. And for Phil Butterfield, there's also room for growth in terms of expanding his knowledge from making wine to operating a business and dealing with customers.
I never thought I would enjoy the people part, but actually that's coming along for me. Quite well. I'm learning how to do that.
Are you an introvert by nature?
Well, I'm an engineer, you know. I'm not totally Dilbert, but I am an engineer. And so there was some discussion whether I could ever be a person at the tasting room. But now I do the tasting room quite readily and easily and seem to do just fine.
I think we're old enough to understand the journey's a big part of it, that there's not kind of a stop sign or a destination, but it's really in learning along the way.
You can sense that this is an exciting change for a couple in transition. Winescape is open to visitors most Friday afternoons and weekends throughout the summer. Inland Journal is open to you anytime. Go to SpokanePublicRadio.org. You can find this week's and previous week's programs and segments on the Inland Journal page. Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.